Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Lauren Groff. Groff was born in Cooperstown, New York, and graduated from Amherst College and the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Her short stories have appeared in many magazines and journals, including The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and the Best American Short Stories of 2007 and 2010. Groff has published three books. Her first, published in 2008, was a novel called The Monsters of Templeton and was a New York Times Editor's Choice selection. Her second was a collection of short stories called Delicate Edible Birds, and her most recent is the poetic and very moving Arcadia. It's a beautifully written novel about the rise and fall of a commune in western New York. It was published by Voice, an imprint of Hyperion Books. And welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, I'm always curious about when people begin to think about becoming writers. Do you remember, was it as a little girl that you started thinking about?
Yes, but I had thought that I was going to be a poet, but unfortunately I have no talent whatsoever as a poet. And I extended this thought even into college and took a few college classes in poetry. And while I love form and actually respond to it a lot in my fiction, you have to have a kind of sensibility as a poet that I just don't have. And I ended up writing long narrative poems that ended up being stories.
Uh-huh.
So that's the way it went with me. So I sort of fell into fiction. It's not easier, but it just is more natural.
Yeah, well,
ability.
I understand, because they are separate languages. And poetry is a special language. I know that. Yeah.
Well, even within the fictional world, short stories and novels are very different languages also.
Well, you know, I was going to bring that up to you, because you write both short stories and you're writing novels now. Has that been an interesting segue between the two? A lot of writers tell me they think they can only do one genre well.
Well, I love them both. They're very, very different. So I wake up with a novel every day, and I try to work on a novel. Most of the books I've worked on have been thrown out.
Thrown out by you?
By me, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I finish a draft. I always finish my drafts, just because I think that it's respectful to do that. And then, you know, I'll throw it out. But what happens is, in the morning, I'll work on the novel when I'm very fresh. And then stories happen to me just in bursts of urgency.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of times in the afternoon, if I have a babysitter for my children, or even if they're in bed and I just need to write this story, I'll write the story. And of course, I mean, most of my stories take 6 months to a year to refine and make okay.
Even your short stories. So.
Right. Uh-huh. But the first initial composition is just very different, because with a novel, you think about it all the time. You carry it with you to the grocery store. You carry it with you to bed. I mean, you're always noodling about it, and you can always work on some part of it. But stories for the initial composition are pure just passion.
Well, see, that is closer to poetry then.
It is. But, you know, for me, narrative. So, yeah.
Interesting. But it's the same impulse, it sounds like.
It is. And, you know, I don't want to force the stories either, I
mm-hmm.
think. You know, I try very hard not to. So with a novel, sometimes you have to force yourself to sit down and just do it every day. And it takes a lot of discipline.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, your new novel, Arcadia, which I found absolutely wonderful,
thank
Lauren.
You.
It's a beautiful book. It takes place in a commune. Starting in the 1970s, obviously. How did you get interested in this subject?
Oh, it's
you're,
very
you're,
personal.
You're much younger than somebody who would have gone through that.
Right. I have a almost 4-year-old right now. And when I was pregnant with him, I was a tremendously bad pregnant woman. Some women are really good at it. They're very natural and glowy and stunning and wonderful. But I went the opposite direction, and I became very sad and very, very melancholic and depressed. And it didn't help that at the time I was researching, you know, the end of the world, all sorts of apocalypse. And I was bringing a child into what seemed to me to be the precursor to the end of the world. So it was just a very, very hard time. And I was waiting for my first book to come out also. So a couple of things happened. One, I made the conscious decision to try to research happy people. And that extended into the researching idealism, and that extended into researching utopianism. And then the other thing that happened is, and you had her as a guest, Ina May Gaskin.
Yes.
I read some of her midwifery books, and I fell in love with the idea and just the passion there and the knowledge and the calm. Yeah. The
and of course, she still works at the farm.
She does.
That was one of the original communes,
she
and
does.
It's still going.
And it's still going.
Which is amazing. It's,
but not in as quite a powerful way as
at one point. A lot less population, too.
But,
yeah.
You know, and I went to visit. So that's the other thing. So I went to Oneida, which is very close to Ithaca, actually. It's not far at all.
Yeah.
And Oneida was a 19th century intentional community based on religion. But the Oneidans were, in many ways, incredibly progressive. And they built this stunning mansion house where you can actually stay now and stay the night and have some breakfast in the morning.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's really, really cool. So I went there just as a almost a pilgrimage, very pregnant, and thought about it and couldn't sleep at night because I'm susceptible to ghosts. And so whether or not it was just the radiator or the drafts, I don't know, but I felt something. And it haunted me, and I went back. And then I went to the farm, and I stayed for just a few nights in a woman's house who told me so many amazing stories about the farm. And I took these home, and my boy was born. And I had been thinking about the book Arcadia as in the point of view of a girl, and then suddenly it was a boy, and it had to be a boy because my son Beckett became Bit in a very real way.
And the protagonist, just for the listeners, is named Bit in the story.
Yeah.
In the Arcadia, yeah. Well, tell us about Bit. I mean, he can't just be Beckett because Bit grows up, right?
No, it's very true. You're right. He's not the same person at all. And I am not raising my son in an intentional community. I would love to, but I have a very conventional husband. It's just not going to happen. But we do our best, and I'm trying to get chickens. So that's, you know, the very best
thing. I was going to say, you and Beckett could build something in the yard.
Yeah, we're going to try very hard. He's just being raised very differently from Bit. But I think that when you work within the sensibility of a character through the point of his teenage years, you know him. And I knew this character very well. And there are major points of departure. My son has developed into not a quiet person, not a watchful person. He was for the first 2 years of his life. He was very similar to Bit in that way, because Bit is a very watchful child and a watchful adult. And as my son grows, he gets more and more different from this person that I thought he was, as they do. But as I was following Bit through his childhood, I could just see the adult developing. And the adult is not very different from the child either. He does a lot of the same. He loves so deeply, and he's so deeply gentle.
Yeah.
So
it's a very poetic book, and it's such an incredible portrayal. The way we could see and feel what Bit was seeing and feeling without many words, right?
Thank you. Yeah.
As a toddler. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. How did you get into that sensibility? I think I sensed that the poet did come out during some of that.
Well, it's always a struggle to try to write from the point of view of a child. And I'm not writing in the first-person point of view.
Right.
I actually didn't read Room by Emma Donahue until after the book, because that book is in the point of view of a five-year-old.
Right.
And I didn't necessarily want to do that, because it wasn't a story, my story was not a story about how this child views the world and how it's different from reality, which is, I think, a lot of ways, some of those the power in Room. This book is about, it's almost an impression of the moment on a child. Just from my observation of children and my memory of being one, that's how I interacted with the world in a very major way. Things came at me in bursts.
Yeah.
Very intense, emotional, and imagistic bursts. And so I decided to write third-person point of view, immediate present tense, in the minds of Bit, but translated into words that an adult would formulate.
Yeah, it was a fascinating portrait. That Bit was an amazing character.
Thank you.
An amazing character.
Thank you.
When you were doing research about communes, did you model the book after just a compilation of different communes? Because it seemed so incredibly real.
Thank
to
you.
Me, the way you portrayed it.
Oh, I did. I did model it on a number of communes. But, you know, honestly, it was really just my two major sources were Oneida and the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And the people of the farm have been...
I could tell that it was the farm, too, because of Ina May Gaskin.
Yeah,
and I did some research about her work in the on the farm and the midwifery school.
Right. I was trying not to replicate the people, the actual people.
Yeah.
But some of the things that happened or in some of the ways that they interacted with the world were so compelling and amazing. And I stole some things from other different utopias as well, or not utopias, intentional communities.
Yeah. Well, why do you use the differentiation of the two?
I don't really know. Over the course of my research, I've come to think that a utopia, because it derives from the Greek, it's no place and best place. It's an imaginary place. And yet intentional communities were real places that people really tried to create. So I think that by calling them utopias, it's almost derogatory.
I see. That's interesting. Well, I was going to bring up the fact that these communes and these ideas around communes and utopias or intentional communities always sounded so logical to me.
Yes, me too.
And most of them failed.
Well, you get sex involved in idealism and things go to pot a lot.
And politics.
And politics, right? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And but that doesn't detract from the nobility of the effort.
Yeah.
I think the effort is so beautiful and so necessary and urgent. But it's true. You know, everything that they at the farm believed in, I believe in. And things came to a head in the early 80s there and sort of disintegrated a little bit. It's just, you know, people change a lot. And if what the community wants doesn't change at the same pace, it just gets untenable after a little while.
Yeah. I found the book really moving, the way that you described everyday life, too.
Oh,
the cooking and just all the things that we've almost lost.
Right.
Because people are eating fast food and they're not sitting together at meals anymore. It was beautiful the way you portrayed that. And it didn't seem idealistic.
You know what it was? It wasn't idealistic insofar as everything has to come from a place and I have shared meals with people that we've all made them together. But It was my longing for that. And I didn't have a community when I moved to where I live now, Gainesville, Florida. And I was pregnant at that point. And so a lot of it was just wish fulfillment. I get to live with a lot of these incredible people who are so smart and so educated and know everything about everything and learn, you know, that's what I wanted so badly. And that's possibly why I created, out of an amalgam of other sources, this town.
Well, you know, I was observing while I was reading this that there are so many novels about the 60s and 70s. And it talks about the failures and people, you know, screwed up on drugs. But Bit is a character that actually learned so much living on this commune. He's like a Renaissance man.
Yeah, right.
I mean, he learned all these skills, building and cooking and growing and... To talk to us about that. And is that something that you had to research too?
Well, that actually came directly from my apocalyptic research.
The people trying to find shelter in the world.
Well, I read a lot of books about getting off the grid and learning how to live outside of the
society.
Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I read a lot of How to Survive, Peak Oil type books, things like that. It just makes sense to teach people how to survive on their own. And I don't quite understand why we don't do that even within society. You know, why not teach a child how to preserve tomatoes or raspberries?
Yeah. I don't understand why we don't learn practical skills on how to live either.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I just don't understand. But we're going to learn how to do this fairly soon. So.
Well, I wanted to ask you this, too. In your research, did you ever meet anybody who actually did live through a commune experience?
Oh, lots. Yeah, many. And that's one of the beauties of living in Gainesville. I would just, you know, even just go to the farmer's market. We have this beautiful one on Wednesday afternoons. And I would sit there, and I would try to make conversation with people. And I would talk to lots of people who lived in a number of, you know, drop cities, Twin Oaks, even tiny little places. In fact, my house in Gainesville that we bought, it hosted a cult in the early 80s for a number of years. And we'd have garage sales and people would come by and be like, I was in this cult. Just wait, listen. And we'd hear these stories where, you know, they wore pink robes and they made the children sleep on the top floor of the garage, which in, you know, a Florida summer is kind of miserable. But, you know, everywhere you go, you're surrounded by these incredible stories, and it's a very American story, you know. Manifest Destiny is the same it comes from the same sort of impulse as an intentional community.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lauren Groff. We're talking about her novel, Arcadia. Now, Arcadia ends in the near future, and it's this really dark vision that you have, that global warming has destroyed cities, pandemics. Tell us, part of your research looks like we're going to end the world.
Well, yes. If we don't stop doing what we're doing, we're on a fast track to doing some very irreparable damage. This also comes from my very deep impulse for how to write this book, because I was surrounded at that time by a lot of anomie, you know, a lot of stories in the media, but it felt like nobody was doing anything about global warming, about the ice caps melting, you know, about intensified weather systems and patterns. And I still feel like we're not doing anything about that either.
Yeah, there's all this resistance to antibiotics that we're hearing about. That concerns me, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I resist antibiotics in livestock, but, you know. But it's just...
No, I don't mean resistance to taking them. People are developing resistance because they take too many.
Exactly. Yeah. People do take too many. And so there are all these things. And you know, you read enough... just intelligent magazines, you start reading these things about, you know, SARS and the next pandemic, because human society has always lived within pandemics. We've always lived within the erosion of our environment, and we've had to build technological ways to move around those. But now it's at such a global scale and in such an increased fast pace. And so I wrote this book, and some of the urgency in this book is trying to respond to that. And I have no answers. I'm just a novelist. But I was responding to this feeling of anxiety and fear. And it's it's no different now from when people were in the Black Forest and there were wolves abounding, and if you went out to the barn on a dark night, you could be taken. You know, so there's always these feelings of tremendous fragility in the human experience.
Yeah, I know those archetypes that we feel are horrific.
Right.
That come out of our brains and the real world.
And the real world at the same time. I feel like humankind has probably always felt that we are on the brink of disaster. It may be true.
But do you believe now that we really are?
I think that if we don't do anything about the environment, we're going to be seeing a lot of pain in the next 50 to 100 years.
I think you're probably right. It was interesting the way this book went from this utopian idea to almost the end of the world.
But it's not the end of the world. And in a way, it's how to survive in a world that's changing so fast.
Yeah.
And how to be happy when you're beset by anxiety. So as is apparent, this book it came out of a place of immense anxiety.
Yeah.
And it was a 4-year fight with myself about how to deal with it.
Yeah, I can imagine. Oh gosh, it's a beautiful and complicated book, and I can tell that it took you a long time to write. It's very thoughtful. You know, I have this great quote from the book. There's a point when Bit starts taking care of his older mother, and she's dying, and you know, and he's living in the real world now. And the book says, "Poetry is what he turns to these days, finding in its fragmentation the proper echo of the disintegrating world." I thought that was such a beautiful line, and so scary.
So scary. Yeah, no, it is. It's a serious book, but I don't think it's a grave book. I think
it's
a book that celebrates the human experiment, whether or not we're doomed the next 100 years. We're celebrating now.
Yeah, exactly. How do you react to reviews? Are you a writer who reads them, you know, and reacts accordingly, or do you take them seriously?
So I do take them very seriously. So seriously, in fact, I'm not allowed to read them. I don't let myself read them because there are two types of bad reviews. So there's the review that's thoughtless, that's sort of dashed off, and even if it's positive, it's still sort of bad because it doesn't respond deeply to the book on the level that one would hope. But then there's the negative review. And I've had really smart negative reviews that I've been very appreciative of, because the reviewer feels like he or she is grappling with the actual book as opposed to projecting a book that he would rather have read.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, so I don't read them. Even if my husband says, this is an amazing review, like the Janet Maslin one in the New York Times was so wonderful.
It was.
But I couldn't read it for 2 weeks because I just
But you eventually do read them. Do you learn anything from them? That's what I often wonder.
This round, probably, you know, the last two books I wrote, The Monsters of Templeton and Delicate Edible Birds, it was just a different experience. I feel like people, the reviewers maybe didn't take them as seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't respond to the book as deeply as I would have wanted. Now, this time, there are a lot of very thoughtful responses to it, and I like that a lot.
What kind of responses have you gotten from the public? Have you been giving readings?
I have been giving readings, yeah. I've gotten great responses. People have been really wonderful. I mean, there are always people who are mean. And
they come up to you and are mean?
Not in person, but they'll send emails. And honestly, the first few months that a book is out, you're just raw. It's so hard to accept anything about the book, good or bad, just because it's almost as if you just had a baby.
I was just going to say, it's like sending your baby out into the world.
Right.
Other writers have described it that way to me.
And you put them in the middle of a coliseum, and all bunches of strangers have a rock in the left hand and a rose in the right, and they'll either throw the rock or the rose at the baby. And you don't want them to throw anything at the baby. Don't throw a rose at the baby. Don't throw anything. So that's how it feels in a way.
Uh-huh. And you continue to write short stories, and do you have another novel in you coming soon?
Someday? Or? Yeah, no, I was just at this artist's residency, and I went for, it was just 3 weeks. It's about the extent of time I can be away from my children without dying. but I went thinking I was going to do this one project. And the project died. It just happens sometimes. And the first few days, it was very sad. And then I just decided to write stories and to talk to my fellow artists. And I went to all the film screenings. I read all of their books, their poetry collections, you know, their novels. And I think that art breeds art in a way,
mm-hmm.
in a way that in the rest of my life it doesn't. And I read a lot of books because we don't have a television. So I read maybe 5 to 7 books a week.
Wow.
But it's not the same as having actual conversations with a visual artist whose work is so different from yours, but is so brilliant. And talking about, you know, music with a composer. So these places are just idea generators. And I have something so tenuous, I can't even talk about it yet. But I hope it will bloom into something beautiful. And if it doesn't, it'll still be in me somewhere. At some point, it'll come out again.
I wanted to ask you this, too. How do you work? Are you somebody who feels like you better write every day to keep yourself in motion, or how do you do that?
I do. I have to. But it's a compulsion because I think a lot of writers have a little bit of OCD in them. I have to do it because if I don't, I'm not a happy person. And there are all sorts of ways that I've had to formulate in order to be as happy a person as possible. Just because I can't be sad. I've got 2 children under the age of 4. You know, I can't be Hannah in Arcadia who just sleeps through the winter.
There is a character in Arcadia, just for our listeners, who's very depressed.
Very depressed. So writing every day is one of those things. The other thing, too, and this is the truth, there are no secrets in writing. It's all just out there. It's an everyday thing. You have to sit down, and even if you don't write a word, you're still paying homage and being humble in the light of the art. Even if you sit down every day for 10 minutes, something will happen. And the words will start to accumulate. And even if you throw out, like me, I throw out probably 90% of the words I write and keep 10%. And that's a high estimate.
Wow.
Well, I do drafts and then throw them out and start over again. Uh-huh. That's just my process.
Uh-huh.
You're still there. You're being there and you're being respectful to whatever it is out there, feet yeah. or...
And it's just that paying attention, too, which is exactly what happened in Arcadia
yeah.
with Bit. And it was amazing the way he paid attention to what was happening around him. Most of us don't. We're just whipping through.
Right, right. And I love his impulse to slow down. And possibly that was just the character telling me, slow down, stop, take a look. You know, not everything is so super important right now to get done. And that was a very lovely thing that he told
yeah.
me.
Well, what else did you learn from that book, though? Because it's such a deep, penetrating book. And it seems to me that you went through so many layers to get to it.
Oh,
did you learn a lot as a writer and as a person through that book?
I learned a lot as a person. I learned to trust my instinct toward idealism. I learned to have a little bit more faith in humanity's ability to get us out of messes and to not succumb to the anxiety. That's something that I definitely learned. You know, just Bit's ability to pay attention was a lesson to me. Bit's overwhelming love of everyone surrounding him
yeah.
was a reminder that I can't be as impatient with people as I normally am. you know, that not everybody is here for me, you know.
Yeah.
So my characters teach me things throughout the course of anything that I write.
Yeah, I was thinking that you would learn something beyond this high-tech world, too, from this book.
Well,
I was going to ask
yeah,
you about that.
Yeah.
How has this high-tech world affected you as a writer, though? I mean, it seems like everybody's so distracted.
Absolutely.
And they're really not saying anything in many ways.
Right. So I get so distracted by the high-tech world. And I'm sort of a Luddite in a way, so I don't have a television. And yet the computer does what a television does. Now, right? You can stream all the good shows, unfortunately. I am on Twitter, but I've been off for the past month, and my brain is different. I can just feel myself thinking differently. I'm not as nervous. I was so nervous.
Yeah,
you know?
I think it causes anxiety.
It does.
It really does.
I think
does.
It does cause anxiety. Yeah. And Facebook, which in a way I love it because I do love seeing my friends from childhood do so well and have their babies. But it's still, you know, the mere fact that crazy people can come out of the woodwork and write mean things to you. I think in a
especially
way.
Especially as a public person,
a public
which you
person,
are now, yeah.
Well, slightly. I mean, Stephen King's a public person.
No, I know, but you're a published writer. You will be.
Right.
It's coming. It's coming, Lauren.
You
know, we are almost out of time. Do you have any contact information if people want to get in touch with you and say nice things to you?
Well, the easiest way is just to go to my website. It's just laurengroff.com, and there are ways to get in touch there. Email, Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff, which
That's
I'm
great.
Now getting back into.
That's great.
Thank
well,
you.
Lauren Groff, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Arcadia. Go out and get it. It's just a fascinating, poetic, really, really moving book.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.